This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Hyperbaric Medical Solutions. If you suffer from a diabetic complication, radiation damage, stroke, or a degenerative condition, hyperbaric oxygen therapy may be right for you. Ask your doctor about how HBOT can help you achieve your optimal health. Call Hyperbaric Medical Solutions at 844-877-HBOT or visit hyperbaricmedicalsolutions.com/Hoffman to learn more. Today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and it is once again time for our weekly Q&A with Layla. That's a session where we answer your questions. We invite you to send your questions to radioprogram@AOL.com. Radioprogram@AOL.com gets you through to us, and we together will endeavor to answer your questions. Kind of like what we do in the office, because, well, when I see patients at the Hoffman Center, they invariably go over to the nutrition department to see Layla to get a nutritional perspective on their health problems. So, how are you doing, Layla?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Enjoying the summer.
Enjoying the summer, yeah. We're in full-fledged summer mode now. And the water is where I sometimes spend weekends is now warming up to the extent that I can actually withstand it. It doesn't take me 20 minutes anymore to, gradually, first dip my toes in, then my ankles, and then my shins, and my knees, and then, get up, to a bathing suit height. And then finally, after 10 minutes of acclimating, I just jump right in. But no, now I can just plunge in and take a great swim. So
there you go.
So that means that summer is indeed in full swing. We have a bunch of questions, but I wanted to comment on, I was very excited following the NBA playoffs. I know that they're in the rearview mirror already. A perspective on LeBron James. LeBron really came up big in the finals, especially Game 7 with some astounding play and led his team to an unprecedented comeback against the highly favored San Francisco Warriors. I did a little background search on his diet. And it turns out that LeBron James is a guy who follows, or at least has at some point or another, a ketogenic diet or a low-carb diet.
Wow.
And a couple of years ago, there was an article in GQ magazine, because, that's the men's fashion magazine, male, masculine vibe. And it's a profile of LeBron James. And it says, here's the headline, "Was LeBron's crazy off-season diet for basketball or Hollywood?" And, he says, in August, he explained to Sports Illustrated that he'd gone on a mostly paleo, 67 days eating only meat, fish, vegetables, and fruit. All apparently for kicks. He was, quote, preparing his body to play at a faster tempo in 2014-2015. Blah, 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 blah. And so, however, the way they portray this is that this is like some kind of dangerous fad diet. That this is like, potentially... you got to be careful, and you can have constipation, bad breath. You can go into like this dangerous ketosis. Ketosis isn't good for the body.
Yeah, they still confuse it with ketoacidosis, don't they?
Yeah, right. Which is the sort of meltdown that occurs in diabetics who can't process sugar properly because they have no insulin. So. They look at they did pay lip service to this, but they they treated it as kind of an aberration. But I think that, you know, that was a couple of years ago, and I think by now, I think people are a little more sophisticated. They recognize that there is a place for paleo diets, you know, certainly not no-carb diets, because I really don't think that a super high-performance athlete who runs up and down the court, you know, like 150 times during the game is going to do well just, you know, eating, you know, meat and salad. You know, I think you need some carbs. And I noticed that with my own workouts. I need some carbs. But I think what's really cool about this is that, you know, here's a guy who is big and strong, but there's an advantage when you're lean, you know, and you're not schlepping around extra body fat. And this is actually an advantage that I think has accrued to me by following a paleo diet. I managed to shed, you know, maybe 6 or 8 or 10 pounds of excess body weight while not diminishing musculature or strength. And that's a real advantage when you're trying to perform.
That's true. That's true. And eating that way just, you know, increases mitochondria, which means more energy. It actually means more energy because a fat-burning metabolism, you get so much more ATP than you do in glycolysis or glucose-burning metabolism. So, and as people, as more and more people find that out, or, you know, just when you change from a regular, say, standard American diet to a low-carb or ketogenic diet, after you get through that weeks of withdrawal, the first week of withdrawal, you know, carbohydrate detox, all of that kind of thing, one of the first reported coming out of the other end of the tunnel, one of the first things that most people experience is more energy and lots of mental clarity. I mean, this is wonderful.
Yeah.
And it's an energy in a way that they never felt before.
Right. You become a lean, mean, fat-burning machine. You know, you just kind of metabolize your body fat stores. And but also, which you dwindle down, which is nice because you can, you know, reduce your fat percentage.
Yes.
But also, I think you become more efficient at deriving energy from food. Rather than going for that, you know, quick fix with sugar, you know, people think, oh, you know, I need that Gatorade, you know, with a lot of, you know, sugar to enhance my athletic performance. You know, that maybe for, you know, if you're out there trying to do a half marathon or a marathon, maybe you've got to grab the Gatorade, you know, at those rest stops to get your electrolytes and a little more sugar in your system so you don't bonk. But, you know, efficient athletes, you know, they don't require that much.
Right. Yeah.
So. Anyway, so I think he's now the official, you know, we got Djokovic, who is the poster boy for the gluten-free diet, right?
Yes.
You know, and then we've LeBron James, you know, on the ketogenic or paleo diet. So it's kind of cool. But I think, you know, part of it also, I think, is what he does, though. I think he does that off-season. And I think that, you know, when the training is, I'm sure he does a lot of training, but the training, it's definitely less rigorous in the basketball season. Plus, he does like a lot of things where he wants to be photogenic, you know, so he wants to look really awesome and thin and look great in those clothes.
And not puffy or bloaty, not
exactly,
that he does
exactly.
Anyway, but yeah.
But, I mean, he makes zillions of dollars on endorsements and, you know, he wears clothes, for models clothes and things like that. And that's, you know, I think part of the allure of of, like,
and you know the thing is during their season when they're active, you know, they're having to take in a lot more calories. He's probably taking in more carbohydrates anyway, so in the off season you can't eat like you're still in training.
Right, exactly.
Otherwise
exactly.
You're going to gain weight.
Exactly.
So it's
I think it's an opportunity for them to get really clean, you know, especially when they on the road maybe there's a little less time to be super careful about diet. But, you know, when they're resting a little bit, then they can do that. But I got to say, I was really moved by the finishing, I mean, to the final game and the finale. I don't know, you're not perhaps not a sports fan. But
I'm not a sports fan,
you know, I watched it, and literally LeBron James and the entire Cavalier team started sobbing. I mean, it was such an emotional moment for them. They were sobbing like little babies, and it was great. And these two teams that have been clashing so viciously, fouling each other horribly, you know, kicking each other in the groin, you know, with personal fouls and things like that. They at the end of it, they just kind of came together and embraced and congratulated each other. I thought it was just a peak moment of sportsmanship and, you know, just a really fine moment for sports. So it's good to
Wow. Yeah. Very exciting sport, basketball.
Yes, it was. I mean, unfortunately, not in New York.
And you know, it's basketball is one of those sports. Basketball is one of those sports that is actually fun to watch.
Yeah.
As opposed to some other sports, I won't mention, but you know, some other sports move very slow. You know, football, baseball can get a little boring.
I can't tell you how many articles I write during baseball games. You know, like people say, "Oh wow, you know, Dr. Robin's
really?"
Dr. Robin's sitting there, you know, in some dark study somewhere, and he's like, you know, he's concocting these articles. I have to say that sometimes I just take the iPad and I put on a really kind of slow-moving baseball game. You know, the score may be 1-0. It's a pitcher's duel. You know, and I'll look up occasionally, you know, when the plays are important. But I'm kind of like multitasking, writing an article while I may be researching something while that baseball game is on in the background. That's the nice thing about baseball. It's like, you know, you have to watch every instant of it. Basketball, I mean, you got to keep, you know, or hockey, you got to keep your eye on the ball because it's moving really
fast. That's
right. This nonstop action. So anyway, let's get down to business here.
Okay, we've got an email from Michael. Dear Layla and Dr. Hoffman, I'm considering consuming water kefir for the probiotic benefits, but I'm concerned about the sugar intake. We use about a quarter cup of raw sugar in about 4 cups of water with the kefir grains, and I understand that much of the sugar will be metabolized during the fermentation process.
Excuse me, what is water kefir? Kefir? I know what
it's kefir. It's the same way you think of kefir. Instead of making it in milk and dairy, you make it in water.
Really?
And it tastes like lemonade.
Oh.
Now, I've never tasted it myself. I've been told by patients who make it at home and use it at home that it tastes like lemonade.
Okay. So it's basically like sort of a sour mash kind of thing because it's got the bacterial fermentation going on, and you need a little sugar to sustain the bacterial growth. I mean, otherwise
you got to feed it.
You couldn't just put the bacteria in the water because there's nothing. There's nothing to grow on. Yeah. Okay.
Exactly. Okay. So the same way that when you make yogurt, it's eating up the lactose, which is the sugar.
Yes.
That's in milk.
Yes.
The water needs a little help, obviously, so the sugar is added.
Yeah.
That the kefir bacteria is actually eating up.
What's your take on that? What do you think the sugar is bad?
Well, I would want to know how long it's being fermented, how sweet it actually is, because I think that should say something. You know, how sweet is it? Is it going to cause you to crave more of this? Do you really feel like you're drinking a glass of lemonade? Then it might be problematic. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. And there's no guarantee that all of the sugar is gobbled up if you're still tasting a sweetness.
Right. How about coconut kefir? Because for people who are allergic to dairy, and you know, with all the benefits of coconut for the gastrointestinal tract, we have some patients who are, some of our ulcerative colitis and Crohn's patients are making, are either buying or sourcing or making coconut kefir.
So is that that's another good source.
Is it commercially available?
No, that's another... Yeah. It is, and it's, we see it more in stores lately, coconut kefir.
Uh-huh.
So even those people who aren't making it,
live culture.
And you could order it online,
Okay. And
you could order just about anything online at this point. So,
yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so all it needs, the bacteria needs something to work on, so whether it's the lactose from milk or the whatever carbohydrates are in the coconut milk, that you can therefore ferment it.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Now, coming back to Michael's question, I would wonder if rather than using a quarter cup of raw sugar and 4 cups of water, he could try using a little less, see how it turns out, if it doesn't turn out, and so forth.
Okay.
You know, and the big tell is how sweet is it?
Yeah.
You know, if it's quite sweet, then not all the sugar is being used up by the bacteria. So that might be something.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting question.
Yeah. Michael, thank you for the question. Oh, speaking of ketogenic diet, we've got an email from Paul.
Yeah.
And actually wrote an article about this in our newsletter too. Paul says, "Hi. So I'm assuming you recommend a ketogenic diet. I have tried somewhat successfully to burn my persistent fat with this diet, but find that the 20 to 30 daily carbohydrate allowance hard to maintain. Mm-hmm. I also enjoy a glass or two of good red wine with dinner, mm-hmm. and I found that this seems to throw my ketosis right out the fat burning window." Paul, that is right.
Right. Yeah, unfortunately.
"Alcohol demands to be metabolized first, the same way that sugar does. So what happens with alcohol is it doesn't necessarily, well, it depends on how much you have. It doesn't necessarily throw ketosis out, completely out the window. What it does do is slow it down. So you want to take that into consideration. Mm-hmm. And my recommendation for anybody embarking on a low-carb or ketogenic diet is to stop all alcohol for about a month.
Right.
Just to help insulin levels normalize, because alcohol is still an insulin trigger.
Yes.
The same way other carbohydrates are. And that's where people get into a problem with that nice glass of red wine
yes.
at dinner.
Yes. And said to
and
be healthy.
My recommendation is always, not more than, you know, if you want to take it medicinally for heart health, 3 times a week, 3.5 ounces is your glass of wine. Now, I challenge everybody to go measure 3.5 ounces. It's 7 tablespoons.
Right, right.
So after about 3 sips of wine, it's pretty much over. That's your glass of wine.
Yeah.
Now, for those people who don't drink, I never recommend starting a red wine regimen. I don't think it's good advice at all to start drinking wine if you were not already.
Someone who abstains, you tell them that they should start drinking, you know, that's maybe not the best idea, right?
No. But with regard to what Paul is saying is he's having a hard time maintaining a 20 to 30 gram carbohydrate allowance. Everybody has what they would find, or as Dr. Atkins used to call it, a critical carbohydrate level for losing, the CCLL.
Yes.
And it's different for everybody, depending on their carbohydrate tolerance. Of course, we get into ketosis starting in phase one, which is generally about 20 grams or less of carbohydrate. But then as people continue to lose weight, they could just slow it down a little bit and increase those carbohydrate grams by about 5 grams. So you could start at 20 grams, get into ketosis, and then go up to about 25, go up to about 30. And then most people are able to manage between 40 to 60 grams of carbohydrates mm-hmm. a day.
What about the scientific methods now that are available for measuring ketosis? Because it used to be they had the keto sticks. Now they actually have blood meters where you do finger sticks like a diabetic, and you can actually determine where you are in terms
right,
of ketosis.
Right.
Have we used any of those with any patients? I think that
We haven't yet. I think some people are relying on the keto sticks, but I remind people that as much as 50% of the people who use them, that stick does not turn purple because they're not forming enough ketones and it's not being excreted through the urine enough, I suppose, mm-hmm. to turn that stick purple. But I tell people don't look for that as your proof. You know when you're in ketosis by A, the way you feel, B, by the way your body composition is changing, C, by the way your waistline is shrinking, and mm-hmm. so forth and so on.
Right.
And the way the scale is moving in the right direction. So we don't need to rely so much.
You know, I have to say
but the keto meter, I think, might be a good idea.
I have to say
for
that
a lot of people.
When it comes to the alcohol thing, I adopted, as many listeners know, because I wrote about this and I also podcast several clinical focused podcasts on the subject. I did the whole 30 diet around Christmas, and mm-hmm. I enjoyed that so much, you know, in terms of the benefits. I didn't so much enjoy the deprivation, but I found the deprivation mm-hmm. wasn't that bad. The benefits outweighed the downside. Part of it was to stop alcohol. And I did mm-hmm. faithfully stop alcohol for, more than the 30 days. I didn't have a drink, and that was hard through the Christmas holidays and New Year's. And what I found is that there's something about alcohol that it may disinhibit you a little bit when it comes to eating. Or, yes. as you say, it may change your insulin resistance. Now, I'm not a particularly insulin-resistant individual. I don't have syndrome X. I don't have high triglycerides. I don't have low HDL, and I don't have, you know, big
blood
waistline,
pressure.
High blood mm-hmm. pressure, waistline, you know, elevated hemoglobin A1C, all that is entailed, or bad cholesterol to HDL ratio. But I found that the avoidance of alcohol was part of the equation by which I effortlessly lost weight because is this something about it that makes you crave maybe more food?
You know what it is?
Yeah.
You know what it is? The disinhibition, you know, one drink is a hypoglycemic.
Okay.
And a lot of drinks is very hypoglycemic because a hangover is the combination of hypoglycemia and dehydration.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So now one drink can be good, say, for somebody with type 2 diabetes because as a hypoglycemic, it helps to lower blood sugar. But what happens when our blood sugar is lowered? We get hungry.
Yeah.
And besides the alcohol and the disinhibition in and of itself, that a little bit of hypoglycemia, because the alcohol is an insulin trigger, that little bit of hypoglycemia is also at play and causing us to maybe eat a little more dinner or then maybe crave a dessert.
Mm-hmm.
Because alcohol is actually a proxy to sugar, and sometimes that can bring on sugar craving as
right,
well.
Right.
So, number of things at work there.
I've always had this theory that one of the reasons whenever you go to a restaurant, they ask you if you want drinks, because most people like to have a little cocktail before they eat.
Right.
But one reason is because, A, there's a much bigger profit margin on alcohol. You know, think about, you know, when you buy alcohol, especially wholesale, and then they, you know, they'll mark it up in like a glass of wine, you know, from a bottle where the wholesale bottle might be, you know, $10-$12. The glass of wine
itself is
like
the amount of your glass of wine.
It's it's like maybe $14 or $16. I look at the bill. It's like, oh my God, I had a glass of wine. Well, thank you for pouring a generous glass of wine. It was $16. You know, so number one, number two, I think people eat more after they've drunk. You know, after they've had a couple of drinks
because it whets the appetite.
It does.
It's the aperitif.
It relaxes your GI tract. You come in, you're a little hyper, nervous, you know, maybe wired from your busy day. And then you have a cocktail. It's okay. Now you're relaxed. You're in a parasympathetic state. Great. Then you want to, you know, your stomach's growling. You want to eat.
Right.
So,
right.
Anyway, yeah. Well, anyway. So look, I'm not, don't get me wrong. I'm not like Women's Christian Temperance Union here. You know, I'm not, you know, walking into a saloon.
Prohibition.
Right.
Alcohol's the devil.
Right. No, I'm not. I'm not. And I don't think that it is. I think it's fine.
Yeah.
But I think it may get a little in the way of an ultra-efficient metabolism. It depends on how much you want to optimize. I mean, some people think, you know, they're going to stay relatively fit, relatively good weight, and they're content with that. Other people want to really go for the gold. And I'm trying a little science fair project on my body as I, you know, move through the summer, you know, with, you know, my usual round of athleticism. And I want to see what, you know, what's happening with the various supplements and the diet that I'm following and my exercise routine.
Terrific. Terrific. Getting back to Paul's, his difficulty with maintaining a low carbohydrate level, Paul, my advice to anyone following this type of a diet is to always have your allowable foods available. You're not allowed to go hungry on this eating plan, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You are meant to eat anytime you're hungry. It's basically eating on demand. So have the foods that are available, you know, have the foods that you're eating always available to you. Have some shrimp salad always at the ready in the refrigerator, or some hard-boiled eggs and some nice roasted vegetables and salad vegetables available as well. And keep the wine down to 3 times a week. Try to keep it under 6 ounces and not more than one.
Right.
And see how that works.
Sounds like a good way to
you know. Right.
Well, all right. So tell me what is in part two, because our listeners know we divide our podcast into two parts. Give us a tease to part two.
Okay. If someone on Coumadin were having a heart attack, would you give them an aspirin to chew on?
Interesting question. Let's contemplate that in part two. We're in the midst of our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein you send us your questions. radioprogram@AOL.com is the destination for questions. I'm with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mutin, and this is Intelligent Medicine.